been at Pizza Max for nearly an hour when Austin excused himself to go to the bathroom. My mother smiled at me, then slid around the vinyl seat of our booth to get closer. "Honey, what's wrong? You're really ticking." I slowly looked up at her. "Mr. Dahlstrom called me down to his office today." Her brow fell. "Oh, what happened?" "Nothing happened. I got offered a scholarship." A smile crossed her face. "What kind of scholarship?" "It's to this really prestigious school in California." Her smile grew even larger. "Michael, that's wonderful. What's the name of the school?" I was relieved to see her happy. "The Elgin Academy." Her smile immediately vanished into a look of fear. "Did you say Elgin?" Her expression frightened me. "Yeah." "In Pasadena?" "How do you know that?" I asked. She turned pale like she was going to be sick. "Mom, what is it?" "We need to go," she said, her voice quivering. "We need to get Austin and leave now. Mom, what's wrong? I can't tell you here." She looked at me intensely, her eyes dark with fear. "Michael, there's more to this than you know. Your father..." Just then Austin returned. "I'm ready for another frosty mug of root beer," he said. I looked up at him. "We've got to go," I said. "Right now?" "Right now," my mother said. "Something's come up." It was dark outside when my mother paid the bill. We were walking out to the car when Austin said, "Wait, I forgot my jacket. Hurry," my mom said to him as he turned to run back inside. We continued walking to the car. My mother was unlocking our car door when a man appeared between our car and the truck next to it. His clothes were dirty and worn, and his face was partially cloaked in a dark gray hoodie. He said to my mother, "Excuse me, do you have a dollar?" My mother looked at him, then said, "Of course." My mother always helped others. She lifted her purse. When my mom's head was down, the man pulled a gun from the hoodie's pouch. "Just give me the purse." My mother dropped her keys on the ground. "Okay," she said, her voice pitched. "You can have it. You don't need the gun." "Shut up," he said. "Just give it to me and shut your mouth. If anyone screams, I shoot." "Don't talk to my mother like that," I said. He pointed the gun at me. He looked nervous and was shaking. "I'll shoot you first." "Please," my mother said. "Just take the money." She handed her purse to him. "Just take it. There's credit cards and cash. You can have it all." He cautiously reached out and took the purse from her, the gun still shaking in his hand. He backed off again. "I want the car too," he said. "Give me your keys and back away." I dropped the keys, my mother said. "They're right there. I'm going to pick them up." "You don't move," he said, pointing the gun at my mother's chest. "You," he said to me. "Give me the keys." I looked at him, then my mother. "Bring him to me now and I won't shoot your mother." "Okay," I said. I crouched down and lifted the keys, then slowly walked toward him. About a yard away from him, I turned back and looked at my mother. "What are you doing?" he said angrily. "Give me the keys." My mother guessed what I was thinking. She shook her head. I looked back at the man. Maybe I'd watched too many superhero movies, but if ever there was a moment to use my power, it was now. I could stop him from taking our car and my mother's purse. I was handing him a ring of metal. All I had to do was surge. I took another step forward, then slowly reached out with the keys. His hand shot out and grabbed them. The instant he touched the key ring, there was a loud snap and a yellow spark that briefly lit up everything around us. The man screamed out as he collapsed to the ground. I had never shocked anyone so hard before, and there was a pale mist of smoke in the air. The man wasn't moving, and for a moment I wondered if I had killed him. It seemed that time stood still. I looked at my mother, wondering how she'd react. She was staring at the man on the ground. The silence was broken by a deep voice. "Well done, Michael." I quickly turned around. I have no idea where he came from, but a man was now standing just a few yards from us. He was sharply dressed in a tan suit with an orange silk tie. Even though it was dark, he wore thick-framed sunglasses. His hair, dark brown with sideburns, was nicely styled. He looked at the mugger, then back up at me and lightly clapped. Really? That was impressive. What was that? 900? 1,000 volts? I looked at my mother, then back at him anxiously. Who are you? My mother asked. A friend, Sharon. A friend and an admirer of Michael's. And his gift. My mother and I exchanged glances. Yes, he said, smiling. I know all about it. As a matter of fact, I know more about it than you do. Just then the thief groaned and I looked down at him. He was struggling just to lift his head. As I watched him, anger flooded through my body. If I had ever wondered if my electrical powers were somehow connected to my emotions, there was no doubt of it now as I felt power surging through me like I had never felt before. I looked down at my hands. Electricity was sparking in blue arcs between my fingers, something I'd never before experienced. It's an emotional reaction, the man said. Fear, anger, hate. The powerful stuff causes your nervous system to react. It's peculiar, isn't it? Normal people respond with adrenaline, but special people like you react electrically. My mother put her hand on my arm. Michael, we need to go. I didn't move. How do you know all this? I asked. The man took a step forward. Michael, we've been looking for you for a long, long time. Almost since you were born. Michael, my mom said. Why? I asked. To reunite you with the others. Others? You're not alone, Michael. There's more of your kind than you think. More than just your friend Taylor. His mention of Taylor startled me. I'd like to introduce you to some of them right now. Behind you is Zeus. Suddenly, a young man was standing next to my mother. He was good-looking but unkempt. He had long, greasy blonde hair and wore a Levi's jacket with the sleeves cut off and no shirt underneath. Even though he was only my age, he had a tattoo on his chest of a lightning bolt. My mother looked at him anxiously. And this is Nichelle. A young woman stepped up behind the man. She wore black clothing and dark, thick makeup, mostly black or dark purple, the way the goth kids do. Both kids looked about my age, though Zeus was taller than me. Zeus, show Miss Vey what you can do. He smiled darkly. Glad to. He lifted his hands, and electricity flew from his fingers to my mother in blue-white strikes. My mother screamed and collapsed just like the man I had just shocked. Mom! I dropped to the ground next to her, cradling her head in my arms. Why did you do that? I shouted. She'll be okay, the man said. It just took the wind out of her. My eyes darted back and forth between the three of them. Who are you? I'm your friend, the man said softly. Nichelle? The girl started toward me. As she approached, I noticed that the Zeus guy took a few steps back, as if he were afraid of her. As the girl neared me, I started to feel different. Everything was out of place. The man, the two kids, my mother on the ground. It was all like a bad dream. I felt weaker. The electricity stopped arcing between my fingers. Then I began to feel dizzy. I looked at the girl, and she looked into my eyes with a strange, emotionless stare. I couldn't make any sense of it. Who these people were and why they were there. More importantly, what they wanted with us. With each step the girl took toward me, my dizziness increased. Then my head began to pound like a bass drum. I put my hand on my forehead as my vision began to blur. Take it easy on him, Nichelle, I heard the man say. He's not used to it. Suddenly I heard Austin's voice, blending into what seemed like a collage of other sounds. I looked down at my mother. She was still, but gazing at me. I saw her lips move, but I couldn't hear her. I couldn't hear anything other than the loud buzzing in my ears. I think she said, I love you. It seems like that's what she said. It's the last thing I remember before passing out. Chapter 16. Gone. When I woke, I was in a bed with aluminum side rails. I was lying beneath clean white sheets, and there was an IV taped to my arm. I felt as if I had been drained of all my energy, and every joint of my body ached, throbbing like a bad toothache. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the light above me. I groaned out, as if expulsing a nightmare. Austin appeared at my side. "Michael?" I turned my head toward him. He was standing in front of closed blinds that glowed from the daylight behind them. Next to him were his mother and father. Austin's father was in charge of maintenance for the county's parks and recreation, so he was rarely home. I was surprised to also see him in the room. I looked around for my mother, but didn't see her. Where am I? My tongue stuck to my dry mouth, and it was difficult to speak. "Honey, you're in the hospital," Mrs. List said. Her face was pinched with concern. "How did I get here?" "Paramedics," Austin said. "You passed out," Mrs. List said. "The doctors were afraid you had a stroke." "Where's my mother?"
"Do you remember what happened?"
Mr. List asked. It hurt my head to think about it. There was a guy with a gun. Then this man with two kids. One of them shocked my mother.
"Shocked?" Mr. List said. "What do you mean?"
I looked at Austin. "Did I dream that?" He shrugged. "I only saw the gunman. Is my mother okay?" Austin didn't answer. I turned to Mr. and Mrs. List. "She's okay, isn't she?" Mrs. List walked closer and put her hand on mine. Her eyes were filled with tears. "I've some bad news, honey. Your mother's gone." I looked at her blankly. "What do you mean?"
"The police believe she's been kidnapped," Mr. List said.
My heart froze. Kidnapped? Why would someone kidnap her?
"We don't know."
My body's pain was nothing compared to the agony I now felt. Tears filled my eyes. How could this have happened? My mother had spent her life protecting and caring for me, and now I had failed to protect her. I had let her down. Why couldn't they have just taken me? I wanted to fall asleep and wake up again in my own house, talking to my own mother. I wanted something to make sense. I wanted the nightmare to end. Chapter 17. Lieutenant Lloyd. That afternoon, the police came to interview me. Mr. List had gone to work, leaving Austin and his mother still with me. There were two policemen, both in uniform. The officer who did most of the talking was older with gray hair.
"Michael, I am Lieutenant Lloyd of the Boise Police Department. This is Detective Steve Pearson."
Detective Pearson waved from behind. "Hello, Michael."
"Hey," I said.
Lieutenant Lloyd said to Austin and his mother,
"We have some questions for Michael. Would you mind waiting outside for a few minutes?"
"Of course," Mrs. List said, putting her hand on Austin's back.
"Let's go, Austin."
Austin looked at me sympathetically. "See ya, buddy." After we were alone, Lieutenant Lloyd walked to the side of my bed. He must have noticed my ticking because he said,
"Don't worry. We're here to help."
He grabbed my bed's railing with one hand.
"I'm really sorry about what's happened to your mother, son. The good news is we have the man who held you up in custody. We're just trying to put the pieces together. I need you to tell me everything you remember about what happened."
I closed my eyes. Remembering what had happened was like pulling a Band-Aid off a bad cut. "I remember some," I said.
"Please, tell us what you remember."
I rolled my tongue around inside my mouth. It felt thick and heavy. I was blinking pretty hard. My mom had taken us out for pizza for my birthday. We had just finished eating and were walking out to our car.
"You and your mother?"
Detective Pearson asked. I nodded. "Yeah." "My friend Austin was with us, but he went back inside to get his jacket."
"Go on,"
Lieutenant Lloyd said. "My mom was unlocking the car when this guy was there."
"The guy with the gun?"
I nodded.
"Clyde Stewart," Detective Pearson said.
His name is Clyde Stewart.
Where did he come from?
I don't know. He was just between the cars.
Neither of us saw him at first.
What did he do?
Lieutenant Lloyd asked.
He asked for some money. When my mom went for her wallet, he pulled out a gun and asked for her purse.
Then what?
He told us to give him our car keys. I handed them to him.
Anything else?
I shook my head. That's it.
Lieutenant Lloyd looked at me with a perplexed expression, then turned back to his partner. Detective Pearson said, "What we can't figure out is what happened to the suspect."
I realized the gap in my story. My eyes darted nervously between them.
What do you mean?
He was incapacitated when we arrived on the scene, Pearson said. He claims the keys shocked him. I blinked several times.
I don't remember.
Stewart was acting like he'd been hit by a taser,
Lieutenant Lloyd said.
We had to carry him into the police cruiser.
Taser? Pearson said. It was more like he was struck by a bolt of lightning.
Maybe he was, I said.
Lieutenant Lloyd wrote something on his pad. Then he said,
We're wondering if the gunman had an accomplice.
Was there anyone with him?
No.
Did you see anyone else around?
There was a man.
Lieutenant Lloyd looked up from his pad.
What man?
I don't know. Just a man. He was dressed in a suit, and he had a boy and a girl with him about my age.
Did he come from the pizza place?
Maybe, I'm not sure.
What did he look like? His face?
I'm not sure about that either. He was wearing sunglasses.
At night? Pearson asked.
Yeah, I thought it was weird.
What else do you remember about him?
Lloyd asked.
He had short, dark brown hair.
He looked rich.
Definitely didn't look like Stewart,
Lloyd said, jotting down more notes in his pad.
Did you see them take your mother?
No, I fainted or something.
Fear will do that, Pearson said. I didn't think it had anything to do with fear, but I said nothing.
Do you have any idea why someone would want to kidnap your mother?
I shook my head.
No.
Why don't you ask Stewart?
We've interrogated him, but he's as tight as a clam.
We know he's hiding something, but whomever or whatever he's protecting has got a real hold on him. Apparently he's a lot more afraid of them than he is of us.
Will you find her?
Lieutenant Lloyd looked at me sympathetically.
We'll do our best. I promise.
He saw the anguish on my face and added,
We're not done with Stewart yet. I've still got a few tricks up my sleeve.
He took a card from his front pocket.
Take this. It has my office and cell phone number. If you think of anything else, just call me.
The two policemen started to leave the room. Lieutenant Lloyd stopped by the door.
Oh, by the way, the gun Stewart had was empty.
Empty?
No bullets. I thought it might make you feel a little better to know that he wasn't intending to shoot you.
He might as well have, I thought. The policeman walked out. Austin rushed in as soon as they left.
Do they know where your mother is?
No.
I lay back in bed.
What did you see?
Hardly anything. When I got to your car, you and that man were lying on the ground and your mom was gone. I didn't see anyone else. I ran back to the restaurant and told them to call the police.
There were three people besides the gunman, I said. A man in sunglasses and two kids our age.
The man knew my name. He knew my mom's and Taylor's names. He knew about my power.
Austin scratched his head.
How could he have known all that?
I don't know.
He brought his kids?
I don't think they were his.
And they had electrical powers. At least one of them did. The man called him Zeus. He's the one who shocked my mom.
He could shock like you?
Sort of. Except his electricity left his body. Like lightning.
I leaned forward.
There's something else I remember. He seemed afraid of the girl.
What did she do?
I don't know. But the closer she got to me, the dizzier I felt. Then I passed out. I combed my hair back from my face. They're not going to find my mother.
Don't talk that way. Have you heard from Taylor?
No, not yet. I lay back in bed. At least she's safe. It's a good thing she didn't come with us.
Part 2 Chapter 18 Kidnapped Taylor shook with fear in the back seat of the utility van. Her head still ached, as did her hands, which were strapped in front of her with plastic ties. She felt as if she'd been drugged. A leather strap crossed at her waist, holding her tightly to the seat, and her legs were bound at her ankles with leather shackles fastened to the floor. The van appeared to have been designed for this very purpose, transporting prisoners. On top of her fear, she felt carsick and wondered if she might throw up. It had all happened so fast. She had been at cheerleading practice for only a few minutes when she came down with an excruciating headache and had to sit down. After 10 minutes, Mrs. Shaw suggested she go home. That was when Taylor first noticed the scary-looking girl watching her from the gym door. At first she went outside and sat on the concrete steps waiting for Michael, hoping the pain would go away. She noticed that the scary girl followed her at a distance. Then the pain got so severe that Taylor knew she couldn't wait any longer, so she began walking home. She was crossing the school's back parking lot when a white van pulled up beside her, the van she was held captive in. Taylor had thought the van was one of the school's food service vehicles, and she hadn't paid much attention until it stopped, the side door swung open, and the scary-looking girl, the same girl who now sat in front of her, stepped out. Taylor's first thought was, "Why is that girl wearing a dog collar?" Her headache immediately intensified until she fell first to her knees, then to all fours, dizzy and disoriented. "Take it easy!" someone shouted. Then a man got out from the front of the van and stood next to her. "Are you okay?"
"I don't think so,"
Taylor said.
"Let me give you a hand."
Her head was spinning, and the buzzing in her ears was so loud that she didn't resist the two men picking her up and carrying her inside the van, blindfolding her and strapping her down to the back seat. Then someone put something over her mouth and nose. That's the last thing she remembered. She wondered if anyone had seen her being kidnapped and called the police. Maybe her father was coming for her right now. She desperately hoped so, but doubted it. The whole thing had taken less than 30 seconds. She'd been taken without even a scream. Heavy rock music played from the front of the van. Earlier, when Taylor woke, her captors were arguing over whether to listen to classic rock or rap. They flipped a coin to decide. Classic rock had won out, and Aerosmith was playing, adding to her headache. The scary-looking girl sat alone on the bench in front of her. The girl was about her age, though a little shorter. She had short, black, spiky hair streaked with purple, black makeup, and she wore a black leather collar around her neck, studded with what looked like real diamonds. She had earbuds in both ears, the white cord running down her neck. For the last hour, Taylor had tried to reboot the driver, even though she knew it would likely result in crashing the van. A crash would at least draw outside attention, and she'd rather take her chances with an accident than with these people. But her attempts to reboot him were only met with pain, a sharp prick in her temples. Taylor decided to ignore the pain and try rebooting again with all her might. She pressed the thought, but the pain just grew. It was like sticking pins into her own head. She finally groaned out and stopped. The girl in front of her turned around and removed one of the buds from her ear.
"I tell you to stop doing that, except it feels kind of good."
"Doing what?"
Taylor asked, her head still throbbing.
"Whatever it is that you do to people's brains."
Taylor looked at her.
"How do you know what I'm doing?"
"I can feel it."
"But you're wasting your time. It doesn't hurt me, and it won't get past me."
"Who are you?"
"Nichelle," she said. "I shake your hand, but..."
She paused and smiled.
"You're tied up."
Her smile fell into a dark glare.
"Actually, I wouldn't shake your hand anyway. And the better question is, what am I?"
"What are you?"
"I'm your worst nightmare. Just think of me as an electrical vampire, and girl, I could feed off you all day."
The girl put the earbud back in and turned around. Taylor had never before felt so helpless or afraid. She thought of Michael and his mother waiting for her. She thought of her parents. They probably hadn't noticed her absence yet, thinking that she'd gone with Michael and his mother. It wouldn't be until late that evening that they started worrying. Her mother would be a wreck, and her father would be following up on every resource available to a police officer. But by then she'd be long gone. Maybe even out of the state. She wanted to be home with all of her heart.
Why does my head hurt?
That's me. Letting you know I'm here. She smiled. I can increase the pressure if you like.
No, thank you.
I thought you might say that. Nichelle turned completely around and looked into Taylor's eyes. The pain started increasing higher, then higher. Taylor shouted out,
"Stop! Please!"
The girl was enjoying herself.
"Hurts, don't it?"
Taylor's eyes filled with tears.
"Yes."
The pain stopped.
"See, I'm what an electrician would call a ground wire. I just soak up all those lovely powers of yours until we can get you to where you're going."
"Where are we going?"
"You'll see. Don't want to ruin the surprise."
"Why do I feel so sick?"
"Funny you should ask. The scientists at Elgen wondered that same thing. They think it's because your body has become so used to high levels of electricity that you don't feel normal without it. That's what makes me so darn annoying."
"Elgen? Are we going to the Elgen Academy?"
Taylor asked.
"So you don't want to be surprised, huh? Okay, then. We're going to the laboratory,"
she said, purposely drawing out the word like she was a mad scientist. Taylor couldn't tell if she was trying to sound comical or scary, but it didn't matter. Either way, it was scary.
"What are you going to do to me?"
"Same thing scientists always do with lab animals. Poke and prod around. And when they're done, they'll dissect you like a frog in a middle school biology class."
Pure fear passed through Taylor.
"Why? I haven't done anything."
Nichelle shrugged.
"Why not?"
She leaned back.
"You ask too many questions. They're hurting my ears. Like this."
Suddenly a painful, high-pitched squeal tore through Taylor's head. She started crying.
"Stop it! Please, stop it!"
"Say pretty please."
"Pretty please!"
"With a cherry on top."
Taylor sobbed.
"With a cherry on top!"
Nichelle smiled.
"Good girl."
The pain ceased. "Now, no more talking. You just be real quiet there, and in the future, should I ask you something, you will refer to me as Master. You got that?" Taylor just looked at her. The girl's eyes narrowed.
"I asked you a question."
Taylor's head started filling with the noise.
"Yes, Master."
"Very good."
Nichelle gave Taylor a big grin, turned back around, replaced the earbud, and lay back.
"I love the abductions,"
she muttered.
"It's the only time I can do whatever I want without getting in trouble. It's been a long time since any fresh glows have been brought in."
A voice up front said, "Knock it off, Nichelle." She pulled out an earbud.
"You're no fun. It's boring back here. I could make her bark like a dog or do something really embarrassing."
"Just leave her alone." She turned around and said to Taylor,
"These old dudes have no sense of humor. By the way, you should have seen what I did to that boy you led us to. Bay. He had a lot of electricity in him. Much more than usual. When I shut him down, I almost killed him. He's probably still in the hospital."
"You have Michael?"
"I can't hear you," she sang.
She winked.
"You didn't say Master."
"I'm sorry,"
Taylor said quickly, afraid she might hurt her again.
"You have Michael, Master?"
Nichelle smiled.
"No. The little guy's friend showed up and we had to go. But we'll have him soon enough. We took a little insurance. You and his dearest Mumsy."
You have Mrs. Vey, Master?
Yes, we do.
A sharp voice came from the front. Nichelle, just shut up! Nichelle leaned toward Taylor.
Now look what you did. You got me in trouble.
She turned back to the front.
Oh, chill. It's not like she'll ever get the chance to tell anyone.
She shook her head.
Idiots, she said under her breath,
once again replacing the earbud.
No more talking,
she said to Taylor. She leaned her head against the interior metal wall of the van. Taylor tried to keep from crying. She was in pain and frightened. She wondered if what the girl had told her about the laboratory was true. Would they really cut her open? As frightened as she was to find out, she had to know. She leaned her head against the van's wall to read Nichelle's mind. She saw images of the school from the brochure. She saw other youths her age, some of them well-dressed and laughing, and she knew Nichelle hated these kids. She saw something she didn't understand. She saw herself at the school, interacting with the other students as if it had already happened. Was she seeing the future? Then she saw other youths lying on the ground, some in pain, others crying in a dark place that looked like a dungeon. She sat back up, unable to continue. Everything she saw in Nichelle's mind terrified her. Chapter 19. Taylor's Arrival. The van drove through the night, and Taylor slept for most of the ride, waking only when a voice came over the two-way radio up front, or when the van stopped for gas. Taylor was given no food, and only a bottle of water that Nichelle held for her to drink, purposely spilling a good portion of it down the front of Taylor's shirt and jeans.
Gross, you wet yourself, she said.
The ride was mostly through desert until early the next morning, when they came again into city traffic. Around 2 p.m., the van pulled into a driveway with a guard booth and a tall gate lined with razor wire. The driver rolled down his window and showed the guard a badge, and the gate opened. They drove around to the back of the building, where a large overhead garage door lifted, and the van pulled inside. When the overhead door had closed behind them, the men climbed out and one of them opened the side door. Nichelle stepped out, then leaned against the van, stretching her legs.
Hurry this up, I have to pee.
Don't get your knickers in a twist, one of the men said. Just stay close.
What would you boys do without me? She said. Ain't it awful? Can't live with me? Can't shoot me?
Don't tempt me, one of them said. One of the men undid the bands around Taylor's feet and waist and pulled her forward. Taylor ducked down as she stepped out of the van to the orange-yellow painted concrete floor of the garage. She was trembling with fear, and felt like her legs might give out on her. Hatch says to take her into the infirmary to get checked out, the guard at the door said to the driver. Nichelle and one of the drivers took Taylor inside the building and down a well-lit corridor to a room at the end of the hall. The sign on the door said, Exam Room B. Upon their entrance, a tall woman with cropped yellow hair, thin-rimmed glasses, and wearing a white lab coat looked up from her desk.
This is Taylor Ridley, she asked the man.
Yes, sign here, he said, thrusting out a clipboard. The woman signed the document, then handed the clipboard back to the driver.
Muchas gracias, he said, and walked away.
The doctor looked up at Taylor.
So you're Taylor.
Taylor swallowed.
Yes, ma'am. Where am I?
I'll ask the questions, she said sharply. You're in my office? I'm Dr. Parker, the resident physician at the Elgin Academy.
The woman turned to Nichelle.
Tell Miss Ridley what will happen if she doesn't cooperate.
She knows,
Nichelle said.
Don't you?
Taylor nodded. The doctor walked up to Taylor and cut off her plastic cuffs with a pair of surgical scissors. Taylor rubbed her wrists.
Thank you,
Taylor said.
Remove your clothes, the doctor said.
For a moment, Taylor just stood there. Then a sharp pain pierced her skull.
Stop! I'll do it!
Taylor said quickly. She undressed down to her underwear. She didn't know if they'd make her take everything off, but she wasn't going to until they made her.
To her relief, they didn't.
Lay your clothes on the chair.
Yes, ma'am.
The doctor lifted a tablet computer from her desk.
Relax,
she said in a tone that only made Taylor more uncomfortable.
We're just giving you a routine physical examination to see how healthy you are. Step onto the scale.
Taylor did as she was told. The doctor checked the number on the scale and wrote on her pad. Most of what the doctor asked Taylor to do was no different than when her mother took her to her own doctor for her annual physical, with one exception. She had Taylor stand against the wall and grasp two chrome bars. Then the doctor put on a thick pair of sunglasses.
I'm going to ask Nichelle to leave for a moment, she said.
Are you going to behave yourself? Or do I need to bring in a guard?
I'll behave, ma'am, Taylor said, looking at the ground.
She nodded to Nichelle.
Stay close.
Okay.
Nichelle walked out of the room. The doctor said to Taylor,
This device tests your electrical pulse.
Taylor remained silent as the doctor attached sensors to Taylor's body. After a moment, the doctor explained,
The electric children have a secondary pulse. Actually, it's more like an EKG. I made Nichelle leave because she distorts the readings.
When the doctor was done running the test, she punched a series of numbers into a machine that spit out a roll of paper.
I shouldn't be surprised by this, she said. Your readings are identical to your sister's.
I don't have a sister, Taylor said.
The doctor looked at her with a peculiar smile, but said nothing. She walked to her desk and pushed the talk button on the intercom.
Nichelle, come in, please.
Nichelle walked back into the exam room. Taylor immediately recoiled with fear. The woman gave Taylor a thin cloth jumpsuit.
Put this on.
Taylor stepped into it and zipped it up, noticing the plastic zipper and snaps.
Nichelle, the doctor said, it's time for Miss Ridley's interview. Take her to her cell.
Chapter 20. A Surprise Visit. I was released from the hospital around 6 o'clock. A social worker from the state had come to my room to talk with me, and it was agreed that for the time being I would stay with the Lisses. We stopped at McDonald's for dinner, then drove to Austin's house. Mrs. Liss had always been nice, but tonight she was especially kind. As we walked into the apartment, Mrs. Liss said,
Michael, honey, you can get your things and bring them over. You and Austin can share a room for the time being.
I'd like to stay in my own room for now, if that's okay. She thought about it.
It is just down the hall. I guess that'll be all right.
Take this with you. She took a bag of red licorice from her pantry and handed it to me.
It'll help.
Thanks. Want me to come over with you? Austin asked.
Thanks, but not now.
He patted me on the back.
I understand. He's probably the only 15-year-old in the world who would.
I walked down the hall. I unlocked the door, walked into the dark apartment and flipped on the lights. Since we moved to Idaho, I had spent a lot of time alone, but the apartment had never seemed so quiet and empty. I looked down at my birthday watch, then I twisted it around on my wrist. My eyes teared up. Where was she? I went into my mother's bedroom. There was a picture on her nightstand of the two of us at Zion National Park in southern Utah. It had been a beautiful day, and Kolob Arch could be seen in the distance behind us. As I picked up the photograph, I wondered if I would ever see her again. My heart ached. I lay on her bed and cried. Sometime in the next hour, there was a knock on the door. I wiped my eyes and walked out. I had assumed it was Austin, but to my surprise, Taylor's dad and a woman I guessed was her mother stood in the hallway. They looked very upset. Officer Ridley spoke first.
Hi, Michael. We're Taylor's parents. Could we speak with you?
I looked at them nervously, reacting with my usual tics. I assumed they were here to talk to me about my mother.
Sure,
I said, stepping back from the door. Come in. Mrs. Ridley's eyes were puffy. Taylor's father put his arm around her, and they walked inside, shutting the door behind them.
Is Taylor okay? I asked.
Mrs. Ridley began to cry. Mr. Ridley said, "When was the last time you heard from Taylor?"
"Yesterday afternoon. She was going to go with us to the aquarium, but when we got to the school, she was gone." Mrs. Ridley began to cry harder. "What's happened?" I asked.
"You haven't heard from her?"
Mr. Ridley asked. "No, sir." He looked at me suspiciously.
"Then you didn't know that Taylor ran away?"
My heart froze. "No. Why would she do that?" He shook his head.
"You know, I'm tough on her sometimes. I just..."
He paused, overcome by emotion.
"I told her that if she didn't start spending more time at home, she would have to give up cheerleading."
He rubbed his palm over his eyes.
"She texted her goodbye."
"We just didn't see it coming,"
Mrs. Ridley sobbed.
"She won't return our texts,"
Mr. Ridley said. He took his wife's hand.
"We wanted to ask you a favor. We just want her home and safe. Will you please tell her that we love her, and we would really like to talk to her?"
"If I hear from her," I said. I felt sick but knew I couldn't show it. "But I'm sure she has a lot of other friends she'd contact first."
"Then you have no plans to see her?"
Mr. Ridley asked. There was a strong inflection in his voice. "No, I haven't heard from her since yesterday." They were both looking at me with a peculiar gaze. Finally, Mrs. Ridley said,
"An hour ago she sent another text that said, 'Tell Michael I'll see him soon.'"
Chills went up my spine. When I could speak, I said, "I don't know what she meant by that, but if I hear from her, I'll call you. I promise." They both sat looking at me, and I guess they were trying to decide whether I was telling the truth or not. Finally, Mr. Ridley said,
"Thank you, Michael."
They stood and walked to the door. Mrs. Ridley stopped in front of my door, blotting her eyes with a Kleenex.
"I don't know if you know this, but Taylor was adopted."
She told me.
"The counselors told us that sometimes adopted children can carry a sense of abandonment. We tried to fill that, but I guess we failed."
"I don't think you failed," I said. "There must be some kind of misunderstanding."
"That's kind of you to say, Michael. Taylor thinks a lot of you. I think if you told her that we love her, she'll believe you. I think she might come back."
"I don't know what's going on, but I do know that Taylor loves you both. I'll let you know if I hear from her."
"Thank you,"
Mrs. Ridley said. Mr. Ridley put his arm around her and led her out of my apartment. As soon as they were gone, I ran down the hall and knocked on Austin's door. Austin answered the door holding a half-eaten toaster strudel. He read the panic on my face.
"What's wrong?"
"They've got Taylor."
Chapter 21. Dr. Hatch and the Twin. The cell Taylor was placed in was windowless and rectangular, with the walls, ceiling, and floor lined in a soft, pinkish rubber coating that resembled the material that pencil erasers are made of. Mounted to each wall were surveillance cameras, speaker boxes, and other sensors designed to monitor the cell's occupants' activities. On one wall were two chrome bars that stuck out about 6 inches from the wall, similar to the testing apparatus in the exam room. In one corner of the room, there was a porcelain toilet and sink. The only thing that looked normal was the bed, which was on a wood frame. Taylor walked over to the bed. There was no metal of any kind used in its construction. The mattress was filled with down feathers. The bed had one other difference she didn't fail to notice: leather restraining straps. The room was lit by fluorescent lighting concealed behind thick plastic plates. There was neither a thermostat nor switches in the room of any kind, and she had no control over light, heat, or air. The people watching her from the cameras would decide when she would have lights and how hot or cold she would be. She had no control over anything. Taylor turned on the sink and was grateful that water came out. She still felt nauseous from the car ride, and she washed her face in the cold water. Then she went and lay on her bed, looking up at the ceiling. She wasn't sure what time it was. She wasn't even sure what day it was.
Mrs. Shaw would be furious with her for missing cheer. Taylor shook her head. Had she not been so afraid, she would have laughed at the thought. If only Mrs. Shaw was the worst of her worries. Besides, everyone would know by now that she'd been abducted. They had to, didn't they? Her friends would be calling one another. They'd organize search parties. Wouldn't they? She thought of how worried her parents must be. Just a few days earlier, they had scolded her for being gone from home too much. The argument had ended with her slamming her bedroom door. She regretted how she had acted. She'd give up everything she had to be home right now. Even cheerleading. As Taylor lay on top of the bed thinking, she heard a quick burst of air followed by a sharp metallic click. Her door opened. Nichelle stepped inside, followed by a tall man in a suit and tie. He wore oversized black-rimmed glasses with dark lenses that concealed his eyes, similar to the glasses the doctor had put on during her tests. "Sit up," Nichelle barked. Taylor sat up on the bed. The man walked to the center of the room. "Hello, Taylor," he said. "You're a sight for sore eyes." Taylor stared at him, her heart pounding fiercely. "He said, hello," Nichelle said. A sharp, piercing scream entered Taylor's head. Taylor grabbed her ears and let out a small scream.
"Stop!"
"Stop it," the man said sharply to Nichelle. "Go." Nichelle frowned. "Yes, sir." She walked out of the room without looking at Taylor. "I'm sorry about that," the man said. "Nichelle gets a bit draconian."
"I hate her,"
Taylor said. She immediately regretted this, wondering if she'd be punished. To her surprise, the man just nodded. "Be assured that you're not alone in that," he said. "Most of the students here do." He smiled warmly. "Let's start over. I'm Dr. Hatch. You are at the Elgin Academy. I hope your trip here wasn't too unpleasant." Taylor looked at him incredulously.
"Why have you kidnapped me? You can't hold me here. My father will find you and..."
He raised his hand. "Your adopted father, Dean Charles Ridley of the Boise Police Department, thinks his little girl has run away. In fact, you've already texted him twice today, telling him how much you dislike him, and how you never intend to go home as long as he's there." Hearing this made her heart ache. Taylor began to cry.
"Why are you doing this to me?"
"Taylor, I'm sorry it had to begin this way, I really am. But once you see things for what they really are, I promise you won't be upset anymore." He stepped toward her and crouched down to look into her face. "Do you know how long I have been looking for you? You're a very special girl. Not just because you're a glow, but because you have something that we can't learn from the other glows."
"What's a glow?"
"That's our term for the electric children. You all give off that faint glow. Surely you've noticed it." She didn't answer. "Of course you have. Anyway, that's why I wear these glasses." He took them off and held them up so Taylor could see. "We invented them right here. They are designed to magnify that glow. I can spot one of you a mile away. Actually, 1.7 miles to be exact." He rubbed his eyes. Then he looked into her eyes and smiled. "Taylor, you're a very special girl, and part of something that's bigger and more exciting than you can imagine. We have a chance to change the world. And I don't mean slap a band-aid on it. I mean throw the past out and start fresh. We could create a society where everyone has enough to eat, sufficient medical care, and housing. A world where life is about personal growth and expression, not survival. No more wars, no more hunger. A world where all your needs are met. And you can be a part of its creation."
"What are you talking about?"
"We are creating a world of people just like you. A race of superior beings." He let the statement ring off in the silence. "Taylor, do you know why you are electric?"
Because your machine didn't work right.
He nodded.
Very good. Exactly. You see, some people, particularly some investors, saw that as a failure, but they missed the bigger vision. We discovered something much, much more valuable. You know, many of the great inventions of our day were accidents. Microwave ovens, penicillin. He smiled. Even potato chips. Taylor said,
"You killed all those babies."
Hatch stood. "I didn't," he said sharply. "The machine did. Accidentally. Accidents with machines happen every day, don't they? Let's keep things in perspective, Taylor." During that time frame, more babies died in car accidents on the California roads than were harmed by our machine. But you don't hear an outcry about that, do you? You don't accuse the car salesman or automotive engineers of being mass murderers, do you? Of course not. Accidents are the price of civilization. Blood oils social progress. Sure, it was awful, but was it worth it? Believe me, it was. He looked carefully into her eyes to see if she was buying his argument. He decided she wasn't. Still, it was unfortunate. And that's where you can help us. And help save the lives of future babies. Would you like to help save babies' lives, Taylor? Taylor swallowed. Would you?
Yes,
she said softly. I thought so. You're a good girl. I like that about you. He leaned toward her. We want to study you to see why you lived and they didn't. You can help us learn what the difference is between your body and theirs. If we can isolate that factor, we can create electric children without endangering their lives. And you, Taylor, hold a very special key to that discovery. Something that the other glows can't help us with. Do you want to know what that is? Taylor slowly nodded. You did well in science, Hatch said. I've seen your transcripts. You got an A- on Mr. Polson's last biology test. Not bad. So you know that one of the tools we scientists use to study genetics is identical twins. Especially those who have been separated from each other at birth. It teaches us things about genetic influences versus environmental factors. What you're born with compared to what you pick up along the way. You, Taylor, are one of those identical twins.
I'm not a twin, Taylor said.
Au contraire, Hatch said with an amused grin. I'd like you to meet someone. He turned back toward the door. Michelle, please ask Tara to come in. At his command, a girl stepped into the room. Taylor froze. The girl looked exactly like her. Before she could say a word, Tara walked up to her and smiled.
Hi, sis.
Taylor's eyes darted back and forth between Hatch and Tara.
I don't understand.
Hatch smiled. Ah, the learning begins. There are a lot of things you don't understand yet, Hatch said. But you will. He smiled at Tara. Have a seat, Tara. Just there on the bed.
Thank you.
Hatch's voice became softer, almost gentle. Taylor, you were born a twin. When your biological mother, a teenage girl named Gail Nash of Monrovia, California, gave you up for adoption, Tara was the first to be adopted. She went to a home right here in Pasadena, just 3 miles from the academy, right here in our own backyard. We found her almost 9 years ago. He looked at Tara, who nodded enthusiastically.
9 years this coming June.
Taylor just stared at the girl in astonishment. Could this be some kind of trick? You, Taylor, on the other hand, were adopted by a family in another state. And everyone knows how inefficient government bureaucrats can be. Your records were lost in the transfer between state agencies. You vanished like a grain of rice in a rice paddy. We might never have found you had you not come looking for your birth records. Taylor felt sick. Austin was right. She had exposed them. There were 17 electric children. We had located them all except for two. You and Michael Vay.
Taylor jumped when he said Michael's name.
Hatch smiled.
Yes. You know Michael, don't you?
She didn't answer.
Don't worry. You did him a favor by leading us to him. We might never have found him without you.
She felt even worse.
He's here?
Not yet.
But he soon will be. In fact, he doesn't know it yet. But he's about to start planning his trip to see us.
He turned to Tara. That's all for now.
Why don't you come back a little later and show Taylor around?
She stood.
Okie dokie.
She smiled at Taylor.
It's so exciting to finally see you. You're going to love it here. We're contributing to the world in a way you never dreamed possible. And Dr. Hatch is the smartest man alive.
Tara looked back at Hatch, and he nodded his approval.
There are some really cool benefits to being here. Like, we're not treated like children. Also, we have family vacations twice a year. I've been all around the world. And we get cool presents.
She flashed her diamond watch.
How many 15-year-olds have a $23,000 diamond Rolex watch?
Thank you, Tara, Hatch said. You can tell her all about it later.
I've got to go. I'm so glad you found us. I've waited years for us to be together. Ciao.
She walked out of the room.
Beautiful girl, Hatch said. Of course you know that, since you're an exact replica.
He leaned forward, his face taking a gentle demeanor.
So let me tell you what you can expect while you're here.
Over the next few days, we'll be doing some general kinds of physiological testing. Basic stuff, blood work, an electrocardiogram, and a full body scan. We also have some special tests we've designed to help understand your special gifts. Nothing painful. We just want to make sure you're healthy. The doctors out there don't understand special individuals like you, and so they miss things. We've already saved the lives of some of your colleagues.
I just want to go home.
Hatch moved closer to her.
Taylor,
I know it's hard right now. You've been plucked from all you know like a rose from a weed patch. Change is always hard, but that doesn't mean it's not good. Usually the hard things in our life lead to good.
Taylor wiped her eyes.
You're not going to let me go home?
Look, just 5 minutes ago you didn't even know that you have a sister. And now you do. And soon your friend Michael will be joining us. You need to stop thinking of this as an abduction and think of it as a long-awaited homecoming. A family reunion, if you will. This is your home.
For how long?
Taylor asked.
Hatch looked at her with a perplexed gaze.
For the rest of your life.
Part 3. Chapter 22. The Revelation.
One thing I knew about Austin, if he didn't understand something, his brain attacked it without ceasing, comparing facts and calculating figures with the intensity of a computer processing chip. Around 9:30 at night, his breakthrough came. He was lying on the couch in my front room, staring at the ceiling as I paced from one side of the room to the other like a caged leopard.
"I just don't get it," I said. "How did they know who I am? How did they know about our powers?"
Austin was quiet for another minute. Then he suddenly shouted,
"That's it!"
"What's it?" He jumped up from the couch.
"I've been trying to figure out why they came after you at all. You weren't looking for those records."
He looked at me, his eyes wide with excitement.
"It's because they don't care about the records."
"What do you mean?"
"They're not trying to hide the information about what their machine did. They're looking for the survivors. And when they found Taylor, they found you."
"I'm not following you."
"Look, these guys have all the records of every baby who survived. What if those other children all had powers like yours and Taylor's? If they discovered that their machine gave those babies special powers, that could be worth billions.
That's a big if, I said.
Is it? You said the other kid, Zeus, shocked your mother, right? So we know there's at least one other,
he spoke the word cautiously,
mutant. The only other people we know who were born at that hospital at that time have electrical powers. So, statistically, we're batting 1,000. There were 17 children who survived. Maybe they all have powers.
He paused, waiting for the last of the puzzle pieces to come together. Then he pounded the palm of his hand with his fist.
It was a fake!
Austin looked at me the way he did when he solved a difficult math problem.
The whole thing with the gunmen was fake. It was a test.
Why would they do that?
Because you don't pick up an electric eel without getting shocked. They first had to see what you could do. You said the man in the sunglasses appeared after you shocked the gunman, right?
That's right. And he said, "Well done, Michael." I stopped pacing. You might be onto something. He knew my name and what I did. And Clyde,
who's Clyde?
He's the gunman. I remember thinking that he looked really nervous. Like he didn't want to be there. He was shaking like crazy. And his gun didn't even have bullets. I looked down. But then why did they take my mom and not me?
Maybe they wanted to take both of you, but didn't get the chance.
You said you heard me coming, right?
Right. But they were gone by the time I returned. They must have run out of time. They already had your mother, so they took her and ran.
Which means they're probably still looking for me.
They don't have to, Austin said.
What do you mean?
They have your mother. They know you'll come looking for them.